to Expanding Your Faith, a podcast that tackles modern-day issues with a focus on spirituality, with Bishop Greer Godsey, Reverend Mark Trim, Father Matt Schnabel, and Bishop Ben Williams. Thanks for listening. Take a breath, open your heart, and let's expand your faith together.
Welcome to this edition of Expanding Your Faith. I'm Bishop Greer, and joining me this evening is Bishop Ben.
Greetings and blessings to all.
Reverend Mark is not with us tonight. He had other engagements this evening, and so it's just the two of us tonight. And we're going to be talking about what the early church actually looked like.
Ooh. That's a deep topic.
That's a deep topic. And it's going to be quite different than what I think a lot of you think it looked like. So this is going to be interesting. I do want to remind everyone that if you want to listen to past editions of Expanding Your Faith, you can always do that at pod.myocci.social or on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. We're on just about every platform out there. Nearly everyone has a picture in their mind of what the early church is about and what it looked like. I would venture to say probably 90% of those pictures are wrong. The early church is constantly claimed by competing groups, Roman Catholics, evangelicals, fundamentalists, progressives, MAGAs, as proof that their version of Christianity is the original one. Tonight is not a history lecture. Rather, it's a pastoral correction with real implications for how we do church today. Bishop Ben is going to be interjecting from time to time from the old Catholic tradition, which is rooted in an unbroken continuity with the ancient church that predates most of the institutions modern Christians take for granted. And one question I want you to hold on to throughout the whole episode, and that is, if someone from the second century walked into your church on Sunday, what would they recognize and what would confuse them? I'll say it again. If someone from the second century walked into your church on Sunday, what would they recognize and what would confuse them? I think you're going to find that's a very interesting lead in there. So I think there's going to be some interesting answers towards the end of the podcast.
Right.
So the world the early church was born into, let's look at some history points here. So, Bishop, the early church was very much a small, illegal, and hidden church.
Right.
It was not recognized as a religion for nearly 300 years. You want to expand on why that was?
Well, first of all, because the emperor, he didn't want anybody above him to be the king or any power above him or making right. money above his dynasty,
right?
Which in a sense was his kingdom. So he made it illegal to have a religion or anything above him. He wanted to be the only power head,
right?
In a sense, so everybody that was in that faith, like the Jewish faith or the up and coming early Christian faith, which was newly forming after Jesus' crucifixion, was because He saw it as something else. He saw it as a threat to his kingdom and his power.
Right.
So everybody had to go and hide under that. But also we got to recall the time that he ordered every firstborn child to be killed because he was afraid of that Messiah, the king, the coming of the king.
Absolutely. And they spent most of their time meeting in homes, in the catacombs. Right. In borrowed spaces, not purpose-built sanctuaries.
Right. They didn't have the temples back until they started setting up actual big temples.
Right. There were no church buildings until the third century. And it was not widespread until after Constantine in 313 AD.
Right.
The church of the first two centuries would be unrecognizable to anyone who pictures stained glass, pipe organs, and pews. And besides, you know, think about it this way. They were migratory because they were being hunted by the authorities. It's kind of hard to carry a pipe organ on your back.
Right.
From location to location.
You know, it's funny. I don't mean to laugh, but I just pictured that. I just pictured a whole bunch of camels carrying the pedestal part and all the pipes down the whole train of camels.
I think that would be pretty obvious and noticeable to people. Yeah. The early church looked far more like a house church or a street ministry than a cathedral.
Right.
And so who was actually in the early church? You know, that's another thing to think about. They were predominantly poor, enslaved, working class, and marginalized people. That doesn't look anything like the churches of today, does it?
No, it does not. We have to recall the mind, too. We have to remember that people don't realize the marginalized were the Egyptians and the people that were lived in Egypt at that time.
Right.
You know, the people that were...
And the Samaritans.
And the Samaritans, exactly. People don't realize that those are the migrant farm workers of today.
Right. Women held significant leadership roles in the first and second century. You know, people like Mary Magdalene were very prominent in the church, not only providing money and resources to keep the early church going, but also fulfilled roles of teaching and evangelism in the early church. Heavily immigrant and multicultural, Greek, Aramaic, Latin, Coptic, all present in early worship. There were no divisions amongst them. They were all one people. Acts 2:44-45 says, "And all who believed were together and held all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute them all just as any had need." Yeah, there were Egyptian migrant workers in Israel during the first and second century. They would come and work the land and then return home with their wages.
Right. And
Egypt actually sent out artisans, farmers, shepherds, all over the known world to work.
What we know today as stonemasons.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that helped build the dynasty for the emperor.
Right. The early church was economically radical by default, not by ideology. The early church made sure to share everything in common because they understood that not everybody had the abilities of the rich and wealthy. So they pooled their resources, helped one another, helped those most in need in their communities. Not something that happens a whole lot in modern day Christianity, I'm afraid. The Roman Empire is context. Worship of the emperor in the first century was required. Christians who refused were seen as politically subversive. Oh, does that sound familiar?
Right. It sure does.
Jesus is Lord was a direct counterclaim to Caesar is Lord. It was a political statement as much as a theological one. That's why in the gospel writings about the crucifixion, it says that the religious leaders of Jesus' day cried out, "We have no king but Caesar." What they were saying is basically, "We have no God but Caesar."
Right.
Nobody is above Caesar. Persecution was real, but inconsistent. Not a consistent empire-wide campaign, but local, often mob-driven. Living under empire shapes your theology, something the early church understood that comfortable Western Christianity often forgets. You know, the reality is that we live under an empire today. We live under the empire that's been created by MAGA and the current president. who is attacking Christians at this very moment with the blessing of other Christians. So for us to say Jesus calls for peace, or the Bible calls us to be a peaceful people, is seen as politically subversive, just like it was in the first century. It's seen as a stand against the political power. And it leads to the administration attacking people like the Pope for merely saying war is bad. What the early Christian church worship in the early Christian church actually looked like. The shape of the liturgy. This is always fun to me. Because what most people view liturgy as today is not anything akin to what the early church actually celebrated. It was a much smaller right. liturgy, much less how shall I say this? Much less fancy and flashy right. than a lot of people today view.
Right. People think that today's liturgy was, well, the bells and whistles and smells and, you know, the traditional incense and the vestments. They didn't have all that back then. They did liturgy in their basic white robes. They wore tunics. They had their basic right. clothing, sandals. They didn't have an altar. They didn't have a chalice. They didn't have any of this stuff. It was right. just the basics of the gospel and the basic of the word.
Right. The Didache, written between 800 and 120 AD, or 80 and 120 AD, is one of the earliest surviving Christian documents and describes worship that is recognizably liturgical. The two-part structure survives to this day: the liturgy of the word, readings, teaching, and prayer, followed by the liturgy of the table, or Eucharist. We still do that to this day, the liturgy of the word and the liturgy of the Eucharist.
The Eucharist, yeah.
Is still very much part of the Roman and old Catholic traditions, and even some Orthodox traditions.
You know, I did want to call to attention. People don't realize, too, that even before Jesus' crucifixion, when he was a young man going to the temple, even the Levitical priests that were there, the Jewish rabbis, they didn't even have a whole ceremony. They just read from the Torah.
Right.
They gave teachings from the Torah from before Jesus' time.
So catechumens, those who were preparing for baptism, were dismissed before the Eucharist. The table was guarded, not because people were unwelcome, but because it was sacred. So the whole point of removing the catechumenates before the Eucharist was that they were not fully prepared for the Eucharist. They were still undergoing training and understanding of Scripture, of the Eucharist, of the church. And so they were sent to study during the Eucharist. And then later they would come and once they are received into the church, they would be allowed to then stay for the whole liturgy. This two-part structure is still present in old Catholic, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and most mainline Protestant worship today. It is 2,000 years old. It is a liturgy of nearly 2,000 years. The Eucharist, in and of itself, the early church celebrated it every Sunday without exception. It was the center of Christian community, not an occasional addition. They didn't do it once every 3 or 4 months, once a year. It was every single Sunday. Justin Martyr, who wrote around 155 AD, describes a Sunday gathering that is almost identical to what our parish here does every Sunday, what parishes across the United States do every Sunday: readings, homily, intercession, bread and wine, distribution, and collection for the poor. The real presence of Christ in the Eucharist was not a medieval debate. It was an assumed belief of the earliest communities. So even from the very earliest point of history, Christians believed in the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ in the Eucharist. This was not something that was just made up in the medieval times. This is a belief that has carried on for nearly 2,000 years. And in the old Catholic Church, Eucharistic theology is not a medieval invention, it is a continuation of the earliest practices of the church. 1 Corinthians 11:23-26, Paul is passing on what he himself received, the Eucharist as tradition, not innovation. And that's Paul from before 70 AD. You know? So we see the Eucharist expressed even in Holy Scripture.
Right.
So,
but see, I think too that people get the misconception of what the actual Last Supper looked like. Mm-hmm. People think that Jesus had an actual gold chalice, and they got this misconception from the Roman Church because the Roman Church uses fine vessels for the community, for the Eucharist, which Jesus didn't have a chalice in the pattern. He had more than likely a wooden cup,
right,
or a clay cup. So they had this misconception of what the actual Eucharist actually looks like.
I agree. And so then in the baptism, we learn from early traditional sources that full immersion was preferred, but pouring was accepted from the very early days of the church. The Liturgy specifically permits, you know, pouring water over the head in lieu of right. full immersion. Baptism was the entry point into community. The community took preparation seriously. This was something that was done deliberately. You know, a person would go through a process of up to 3 years of preparation before they were baptized. You know, many people today get pissed off at having to go through 6 months worth of classes before getting baptized or received into the church. Imagine 3 years of preparation.
Right.
Baptism was tied directly to belonging, to the community meal, to mutual care, not just a personal spiritual transaction. When you were baptized, you became family. You became part of the family of God. And that also meant that you then participated in the sharing amongst one another, the caring for each other, you know, making sure that everyone had food to eat, everyone had their daily necessities met, not just going and sitting there and listening and then leaving. You were part of the active work of the church. That's another thing that a lot of people today do not understand or accept or follow. Connection. What would it mean for churches today to treat membership as seriously as the early church treated baptism? Mm. You know, a lot of churches, people just come and sit in the pew every Sunday. Most people don't even know who they are. Never talk to them. Never greet them. That was something that the early church found to be abhorrent as they discussed creating deacons, raising up deacons in the early church to specifically make sure nobody fell through the cracks. Today, people falling through the cracks is just seen as part of the business of church. You know, you're going to have some people fall through the cracks. Well, that's not how the early church saw it. Nobody should fall through the cracks. So what was not present in the early church? No Christmas or Easter celebrations. That didn't start until the 3rd and 4th century. No mandatory clerical celibacy. Married bishops, priests, and deacons throughout the New Testament and in the early centuries of the church. No papal supremacy is currently defined. Rome was honored as a prestigious see, not as a judicial head of all churches. I know that's going to piss off a lot of Roman Catholics. No Nicene Creed until 325 AD. Earlier creeds were simpler baptismal confessionals or confessions. Much of what people assume is ancient is actually medieval. It's not ancient. The early church didn't have a lot of these things we consider staples of Christianity today. Right, Bishop?
Right. And I want to, if you can please allow me, I would like to backtrack a little bit.
Go ahead.
Back to the baptism part. People don't realize that when a church, they say you got to be baptized to be a member of the church. People don't realize that they don't really have to do that. One baptism is enough.
Right.
And also, people don't realize, they do it because they feel like they're being forced or coerced to doing it. I say don't do it unless you really want it in your heart to do that.
Right.
Because doing a baptism freely means a lot. If you're doing it because you feel necessary, you're being pressured to do it, then it's not gonna work the way it's intended to work.
Right.
The way that God instituted the baptisms.
Right.
Because if you can't do it full with your full heart and soul, don't do it at all.
Agreed.
I didn't mean to get off track. You know,
that's well on track with the fact that, you know, there are people who are out there who go and get baptized just for the sake of being baptized.
Right. And they sit in the pew every Sunday because they say, well, you know, I'm here because it's not because I because it's a routine or a habit because they do because their parents did it.
Right.
Don't go and sit in a pew and go because it's a routine. Go because you need to be fed spiritually, you know. You're hungry for the word.
Right. So what did leadership and structure in the early church look like?
Wow, that's a deep question there.
Well, and it's going to surprise a lot of people.
Right, it will.
There were three orders, bishop, presbyter, and deacon, or bishop, priest, and deacon. By the early 2nd century, Ignatius of Antioch, who died in 108 A.D., so we're talking prior to 108 AD, describes a clear threefold order, one bishop per city, surrounded by a council of presbyters or priests, and served by deacons. This is the structure that our church has maintained, okay? The bishop was not a distinct administrator. He was the pastor of a local community, known personally to his people. And Ignatius makes the comment in his writings, where the bishop appears, let the people be there. Just as wherever Jesus Christ is, there is the church Catholic. It is the first known use of the term Catholic.
Yeah. In other words, for people that don't understand, church universal.
Right. Women in leadership. Romans 16 names Phoebe as a deacon. Diakonos, the same word used for male deacons. Eunia as an apostle. Priscilla as a teacher. The office of deaconess was formalized and active in the early centuries of the church. Evidence from the catacombs and early church art shows women presiding at meals that look Eucharistic. They were the agape meals that we now know as Mass.
Right.
The systematic removal of women from ordained ministry happened gradually through the 4th and 5th centuries as the church became more institutionalized and accommodated the Roman patriarchal culture. This is not modern progressive revision. It's historical record. We know of so many women who served as bishops, priests, and deacons throughout the years, whose information has been suppressed or hidden because the church doesn't want that information known. It's more important to maintain the patriarchal system than it is to follow the actual early church traditions. And I think that women have an important role in the church today in ministry. You know? They certainly do. Maddie says, I'm not sure the early church believed in a modern day hell either. Not in the sense of what we have come to believe it today, no.
Right.
That's absolutely correct.
And, you know, to talk about the role of the women in the church, people take the scripture of that women shouldn't talk in church out of context.
Right.
Because that didn't mean what it meant to me. They couldn't teach. It meant, you know, it basically meant, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Bishop, because you know too, that it basically meant that you're not supposed to gossip in church.
Right.
It didn't mean that they should be silent, period, and not have a role.
Something that a lot of people forget is that Paul's writings were directed at specific churches.
Right.
Dealing with specific issues. For instance,
yeah.
We only have half the conversation.
Right.
We don't have the original letters written from the church to Paul. We only have Paul's response.
Right.
But we can surmise from the other things he says in his books to the church, they were dealing with a specific issue in the churches with women who were gossiping, backbiting, causing dissension. And Paul says, when you're at church, those women need to remain silent, not be gossiping, not be abusive, not be attacking others. Not that they shouldn't be teaching, but that they shouldn't be causing disruption in the church with things, doing things that they know to be unchristlike. So the early church governance was conciliatory, meaning that it was governed by councils. Decisions were made by gatherings of bishops together, not by a single authority, not by a papal figure. The great ecumenical councils, Nicaea in 325, Constantinople in 381, Ephesus in 431, Chalcedon in 451, were not papal decrees. They were assembled bodies of bishops from across the church. There was no pope overseeing them. They were a council of bishops. Papal primacy, as currently defined by Rome, was not the ecclesiology of the early church. It developed gradually and was contested throughout, all the way up to the point of 1054 with the Great Schism. In the old Catholic Church, our polity directly reflects this conciliar model. We are run as a council of bishops. While we have a presiding bishop, the presiding bishop speaks on behalf of the council of bishops, not instead of or above them. And the presiding bishop in old Catholicism is the first among equals, not, you know, the prime bishop or the supreme bishop, the supreme ruler of the church. And so what role did laity play in the first century church? The early church had no sharp clergy-laity divide in terms of participation. The congregation was expected to bring gifts, pray aloud, discern together, and hold leaders accountable. In fact, in 1 Peter 2:9 it says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a purchased people." The priesthood of all believers was not a Reformation invention. It was apostolic. I mean, the first book of Peter was written in the first 100 years of the church. I mean, it reflects the prevailing thought of the earliest members of the church. In our parishes in Old Catholicism, as well as many other church denominations, model that engaged participatory community that is more historically grounded than a passive audience model that most modern parishes use. Our people have a say in what goes on in their parish. It is a great thing to have. Your thoughts, Bishop?
Well, you know, I was going to go back a little bit, backtrack to the dates, you know, because people don't understand that they get confused between the Great Schism and the forming of the Old Catholic Church in the Netherlands. Right. They get confused with the dates. 1122 is when we were actually founded. But the Old Catholic Church in the Netherlands took the name and used it before. They usurped the name from us.
Right.
But you know, people don't get that, understand that. And I wanted to make sure that was clear because it is a very, very important part to know.
Right.
And as far as people having a role within the church, I think it's a very good thing that people not recognize too, that parishioners play a big part in the church, whether it be a volunteer at the door. And this is talking about modern days. It's not talking about the olden day, but even the olden day, they had a volunteer, I'm sure, welcoming people at the door. I'm sure they had people pouring water for drinks.
Right.
You know, even now, we have people that help out with donuts, coffee, etc.
Right.
Being, in a sense, being that steward of being the deacon, the actual fellowship as a family in the church.
An emperor asked, "You have female priests?" Yes, we have female priests just like the early church did in the first century. Absolutely. So what was the theology of the early church? Especially those theological points that would surprise people like Matthew Johnson, who is making threats on TikTok currently. Actually, we just proved that they did, Emperor. You might want to go read the entirety of Paul's writings as he talked about women clergy all the time, but by all means.
Yeah, we already discussed it, the female clergy, that scripture is incorrect and people misinterpret what it means.
That's okay, so. Emperor. You know, we understand that you want to be a misogynist and be abusive to women because, well, that's how you believe Jesus acted. So now that I have to do editing on this episode, which I really hate having to do because it takes so much time. All right, theology that the early church held that surprises people today. Hell was more complicated than you think.
Right?
Origin of Alexandria from around 185 to 253 AD taught the ultimate restoration of all things, possibly including all souls. It's called a Pasakatitis. He was not a fringe figure. He was the most influential theologian of the third century. And he basically taught universalism. Gregory of Nyssa, a Cappadocian father and saint in both East and West, held a version of your universal hope, the idea that eternal conscious torture is the only orthodox position, is historically inaccurate and worn out. And it worn out, but is not uncontested in the early centuries of the church. So the idea of an eternal hell is created by those who basically want heaven to be an exclusive social club,
right,
for them and their friends. It is not a universal point held by the entirety of the faith. Like I said, Origen, Gregory of Nyssa, These are not people that would be considered liberal by any stretch of the imagination. They're more
conservative, correct?
They were very conservative about their faith beliefs than right. most people think. So when we say that hell doesn't exist, we're actually holding to the early theology of the church, not a theology that was made up recently. The poor were a theological priority, not a charity project.
Right.
St. John Chrysostom, Archbishop of Constantinople, who died in 407 AD, said, "The rich man is a thief." The early fathers were economically radical by contemporary standards. Basil of Caesarea built what may be the first hospital in history and wrote extensively that hoarding wealth while others starved was a sin, not a lifestyle choice. The early church's care for the poor was not social work alongside ministry. It was an expression of Eucharistic theology. What you do at the table, you do at the streets. I like that. What you do at the table, you do in the streets.
I like that too. That rings so true.
And yet so many churches today deny the poor, turn their back on the poor, refuse to help the poor. The early church made it part of their theological beliefs, so much so that it was a core tenet of first century theology. Not one of those things of, oh, well, since we have nothing better to do on this Thursday, let us go out and help the poor. It was an everyday thing. And St. Francis of Assisi in the 1200s attempted to bring the church back to that way of thinking, to bring the church back to that thinking about caring for the poor, the sick, those most in need in community. And the church resisted, and it still resists to this day. You know, the majority of people who come into our lives at night on TikTok and YouNow, they attack us for being woke, for being liberal, because we say things like the poor should be taken care of, women should be treated with respect, all should be welcome at the table. But as we're seeing, the early church actually taught those things. So what they're essentially doing is they're attacking the foundations of Christianity, the foundations of Catholicism, in order to maintain their wealthy lifestyle or their abusive behavior towards others. That's very sad.
And, you know, I wanted to touch on that a little bit, too, because we really look at it. The reason why the churches don't want to help poor people and people that are in need is because they don't have no money to put in the pot.
That's right.
But that's not what it's about. Even the early church shows us that's not what it was about.
Right.
It was about having compassion for people, helping them out in their time of need. St. Francis even said, we are to help the needy, the hungry, the marginalized.
Right. 100%. And another No, go ahead.
It's not our job to pick and choose who we want to serve.
That's right.
We have to be the true leader of the church. We have to get our hands dirty.
Very true. Creation was also sacred to the early church. Early theologians did not hold the Gnostic disdain for the physical world. They actively fought against it. Irenaeus of Lyon, who died in 202 AD, argued vigorously that matter is good, the body matters, and the resurrection is physical. This is the theological root of sacramental Christianity, God works through physical things: water, bread, wine, oil, touch. This is also a connection to our Franciscan charism, our Franciscan spirituality. Saint Francis of Assisi's praise of creation and the canticle of the creatures is continuous with this ancient tradition. The early church believed in caring for the world God gave us, not just caring for, you know, caring about destroying the world, you know, removing its resources. It cared about preserving what God created. The church existed for the world, not for itself. And this is the big difference between the early church and modern churches today. The Epistle to Dionysius, early second century, says, Christians live in the world, but are not of the world. What the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. Wow.
That's deep.
The early church understood its presence in cities and neighborhoods as a form of witness and service. Rodney Stark's research and his work, The Rise of Christianity, documents that Christians staying in cities during plagues to care for the sick, including non-Christians, was one of the primary reasons the church grew. The church did not grow primarily through preaching campaigns, through standing on the street corner with a sandwich sign, not by shouting people were going to hell, but through presence, care, and community. The church today has forgotten that, completely forgotten right. that. We're called to go out into the world and be part of the world. We're called to be out there helping those most in need, taking care of the sick, the poor, the destitute, the marginalized. Not just Christians, but all people. Right. And Jesus says if you live your life that way, it will draw people to the Father. He didn't say go stand on the street corner and yell and scream and holler. Don't carry around signs that say, you know, these people are going to hell. In fact, Jesus attacked people who did that and said that they were doing that for their own glory and edification, that they've already received their reward. He called us to live in a way that people want to live like us.
Right. And also, people don't realize, too, that Jesus actually said that he has other flocks that you may not know of, meaning right. other religions. So we are not to judge other religions, Muslim, Mormon, whatever. We are right. here to help them regardless.
Right.
I guarantee you within the old Catholic Churches International, if somebody walked into our sanctuary and asked for help, regardless of their Muslim, whatever religion, we would help them, not turn them away.
Absolutely. 100%. And so what does this mean for how we do church now?
Wow.
If the early church is your standard, you'd end up closer to one of our parishes in the OCCI than doing what most mega churches do today.
Right.
Small communities gathered around a real table where a pastor who knows your name, practicing radical economic sharing, welcoming the marginalized, governing collegially. This is not progressive innovation. It is ancient practice.
Right. That's where we come into where the topic is going to be, you know, community building, a place of belonging.
Right. Absolutely.
It's not meant to be where you walk into a mega church and you got lights and lasers and spotlights and the show open. And I call it a show for a reason. It's not to be meant to be opened up like a rock band, like a rock concert.
Right.
That's not what church is about.
And the old Catholic tradition's claim is not that it invented something new.
Right.
but it has refused to abandon something old. My encyclical that just came out, it's going to go public in the next few days, on the history of old Catholicism, speaks to that. The fact that we maintain the ancient traditions of the church, refusing to cede them to modern innovations of greed, of power, of abuse. Instead, we hold to the ancient traditions. So, Bishop Ben, what does it feel like to stand in apostolic succession to these communities of the past?
Well, for me, standing in that light is kind of impressive, but also hard at the same time, because we have to be that bearer of that light and actually be the bearer of that apostolic succession, which is passed down to us.
Right.
And we have to embody the early church. We cannot conform to the modern day bendings of what people want.
Right.
You know, like we look at today's society, and we have the Christian nationalists, the MAGA party. They want the hateful Jesus, the hateful God, the vengeful God. What happened to the Beatitudes? We as clergy have to embody the Beatitudes. We have to embody welcoming the stranger, the marginalized, the oppressed. We have to help our communities. And if not, we're not embodying the early church. That's we're right. embodying what? The modern church. Greed, right. power, hateful. That's we're right. not called to do that. If that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. I asked you all to keep a question in mind at the start of this podcast.
Here comes the deep question.
And so I'm going to ask it again. After everything that you've listened to tonight, if someone from the second century walked into your church on Sunday, what would they recognize and what would confuse them?
Wow.
And I want to reflect on that for a moment from my own parish's perspective. I think they would recognize the Eucharist. I think they would recognize the outreach spirit that we have to the poor and the homeless, to the marginalized, that spirit of welcoming all to the table, regardless of who they are, regardless of where they come from, regardless of their faith, regardless of their gender, regardless of their sexuality. Welcoming everyone like they did in the early church. I think it would greatly confuse them that we meet in these large buildings with pews, and we have all these beautiful computers and PowerPoint presentations and all of that stuff. I think that that would confuse the heck out of them. But I think they would also be proud to know that we're using the resources God gave us to build a welcoming and affirming and supportive community like they did in the first and second centuries. If you've been,
you know, I was gonna elaborate on that a little bit. You know, because talking about the modern churches versus the old churches, and what would they recognize? I think within our church specifically, the people, if they came in from that second century to the state of Philadelphia, they would recognize Bishop St. George's Church, because they do home churches. They do home right. services.
Right.
Homebound services, which is the indicative of the early church.
Indeed.
Now, would they recognize in other churches? They would be thrown off by the music, by the bands, the rock bands, the praise teams. They didn't have that back in the second century.
No, they did not.
But they would truly recognize us, because we have the caring and the loving community, which was indicative of the second century churches.
That's right. 100%. If you've been told the traditional church is the one with most rules, the most hierarchy, and the most exclusion, I'm here to tell you history says otherwise. And hopefully you've seen that in our episode tonight. So just to recap, the early church was small, poor, diverse, Eucharistic, conciliar, and world-facing. And I can't say it any better than that.
Right.
The church that looks most like it is not necessarily the biggest or the most influential. So I want to thank Bishop Ben for being here tonight.
Thank you for having us.
And all of you for joining us this evening for our podcast. Just a reminder, you can find our previous editions on pod.myocci.social or on Apple Podcast. You can always join us for live broadcast. Next week is our last one for this season, and then we're taking a month break for the month of May and back in June, the first Saturday in June. You can join us for live recordings at 8 p.m. Eastern on younow.com/Bishop Greg or on TikTok at symbol expanding your faith. Until next time, when we once again attempt to expand your faith, keep shining bright, my friends.
Thanks for spending this time with us on Expanding Your Faith. If today's conversation encouraged you, share the episode. It helps more people find the show. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and you can also find us online at pod.myocci.social and rstfrancis.org. Follow us on Facebook at Expanding Your Faith. Our producer is Bishop Ben Williams. Expanding Your Faith is an outreach ministry of St. Francis Parish and Outreach in Augusta, Georgia, produced in cooperation with the Metropolitan Community Church of Our Redeemer in Augusta, Georgia. Until next time, keep expanding your faith.